Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is April 8th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is The Secret of NINS, Tissue Plasminogen Activator for Acute Ischemic Stroke, or the NINS trial. And this will be another SGEM classic paper episode. And for a classic episode, we need a classic guest skeptic. So joining us once again is Dr. Anand Swaminathan, or Swami as he's known to his friends. He's an assistant program director at NYU Bellevue Hospital in the Department of Emergency Medicine. Swami is a EM myth buster, love the myth busting, and a strong supporter of the FOMED movement. Welcome back to the SGEM, Swami.
Good to be here, Ken.
I hear, preparing for this, that we have some things in common. We both want to be runners, and you've run some marathons, I understand.
Yeah, so we were chatting about this before. You're getting ready for Boston, and I have run a couple marathons before. I've done New York three times. The first time I did it was actually in 2001, right after the September 11th attack, so that's still a really vivid and wonderful memory that I have. The rest of the marathon, I'd like to forget.
Yeah, you know, I can imagine that that marathon must have been something else after the 2001 Twin Towers episodes. And it sort of makes me, I'm kind of like a little apprehensive because I'm heading back to Beantown in 2 weeks to run the Boston Marathon. And some of the SGEM listeners may remember that I came about 430 meters short of finishing last year due to the bombing. And my official result was posted as DNF, or did not finish. Well, this year I plan to be another DNF, but this time DNF will stand for Do Not Forget Boston 2013. It was a surreal experience. The first responders were amazing, and that's about as close as I ever want to get to being part of history.
Yeah, you know, Ken, I think it's really amazing to get to do this. I have lots of friends in Boston, and, you know, after that event, my heart really goes out to them, and I think this is going to be an absolutely amazing year for the Boston Marathon with all of that emotion behind it.
Hey, and you had a great idea for SMAC USA, didn't you?
Yeah, so, you know, I think we're all getting pretty excited that SMAC is coming to our part of the world. A lot of us are already gearing up for Chicago in May of 2015. And, you know, after talking about this, I realized there's probably a lot of people in emergency medicine who are runners. And so I would like to ask Chris Nixon and the rest of the team that does SMAC, we should put together a 5K run, a little fun run at SMAC in Chicago, which is a great city to run in. I think that'd be a lot of fun. And May is a perfect month to have a sort of fun run or race in Chicago.
A foamy fun run. I like the idea. But enough banter. Let's get back to the podcast on hand. The first SGEM Classic was a huge hit. People loved having a review on a groundbreaking, practice-changing, historical article.
Yeah, so last time we discussed the OPALS trial by Ian Steele on ACLS for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And our basic conclusion was that there is no evidence that ACLS drugs improve survival to hospital discharge.
Yeah, and the music I picked for that classic episode was Masterpiece Theater. Now, this was because the OPALS trial was a masterpiece, if I say. The crowd has spoken, and they have demanded more classic papers.
So here we go again then, Ken. In fact, you know, NINS was the first paper that I suggested we cover as a classic. And you were like, whoa, Swami. Whoa there, big fella. Let's not go ahead and tackle the arguably not just biggest paper, but clearly the most controversial paper in emergency medicine to start. We started out a little bit less controversial with OPALS.
Yeah, Swami, I was a little resistant to start with the NINS. But that first classic SGEM podcast was such a huge hit. Why not tackle NINS now? But did you notice that for the theme music for this classic episode, I picked the Antique Roadshow? That is because NINS is an antique. I mean, it was published almost 20 years ago. Hard to believe it's been so long. Swami, can you get this SGEM episode started with a case scenario?
Absolutely. So We have an 85-year-old woman who presents to your emergency department. She's got left leg and arm weakness. She's got slurred speech, and all of this has been going on for about 2 hours. She's got a history of hypertension and diabetes. Her vitals are unremarkable, except for a blood pressure of 202 over 115. She gets a non-con head CT performed that shows no acute intracranial pathology. And when she comes back from CT scan, she's actually speaking clearly, but she still has some weakness. It's now about 4 out of 5 in the left upper and lower extremity. Your stroke team was already called, and they ask you to administer Alteplase.
So the question for the podcast today then is Alteplase an effective treatment in patients who present with signs of an ischemic stroke of less than 3 hours duration?
So Ken, I think the best way for us to start tackling this is we need to pretend. We need to go back in time and pretend that we're in 1995.
Ooh, we're so, back to the future, are we?
We're sending you back to the future.
We are back to the future, absolutely. A little bit of a hot tub time machine, Ken. So I was just graduating from high school in 1995. The Yankees made the playoffs for the first time in over a decade, which was sort of pretty great for me as a Yankee fan and started one of the greatest dynasties in sports. I looked this up and Coolio was a hip-hop artist, not a reality show star, and he had the number one song that year, Gangsta's Paradise, which led to one of my favorite parodies by Weird Al Yankovic, Amish Paradise.
Well, in 1995, I had just started my residency, and believe it or not, it was an orthopedic surgery. Yes, Swami, I started off bone broke, me fix. I'd been married for 3 years to Barb. Yes, that's Ken and Barb, not Ken and Barbie, Ken and Barb.
Yeah, and I think now that we've sort of put ourselves back in that time, we can sort of talk about this. So, you know, just as big as you becoming an orthopod, the Yankees getting into the playoffs, and clearly with more long-lasting effects was the publication of the NIN study in 1995. So just as a little bit of background, about 22 million patients worldwide will experience a stroke, and 50% of these are ischemic strokes. For years, there was really no effective treatment for these patients. A lot of the old-timers I work with talk about that when a patient came in with stroke in the middle of the night, they'd kind of park them in a corner, and the neurologist would get called in the morning because there was nothing for them to offer at 2 o'clock. As a result, the burden of ischemic stroke was enormous. Patients often experience debilitating strokes, and they require round-the-clock care.
Yeah, it represents one of the leading causes of disability in our society and the third most common cause of death. And for the longest time, there was nothing that could really be done for acute strokes. And then, dun-dun-dun, thrombolytics.
Yeah, you know, lytic agents, we used these before stroke. We used these for MI in the early 80s. And we kind of have to remind ourselves of that because now everybody gets PCI, or at least most patients do. But at that time, treatment for MI was also a little bit limited. We didn't have stents. So patients either got CABG or simply had completion of their infarct while the physician crossed their fingers that they wouldn't experience mortality from that.
Well, we did provide something called MONA. Do you know what the mnemonic for MONA stood for?
Yeah, I learned that in med school. It was morphine, oxygen, nitrates, and aspirin.
You are a star. I can't stump you.
I remember this, and I think we've pretty much dropped morphine out of that, but we do stick with the other three as well. Now, lytic agents in MI were shown in multiple studies of over 60,000 patients to offer about a 1% to 2% improvement in mortality. And that was pretty consistent across all of those studies. Additionally, they found that lytic agents were more useful when they got applied to patients with ST elevation MIs and was indirectly related to the time from onset of symptoms. Therefore, the earlier in the disease that the lytics were given, the better outcome. And this led to the idea that time is heart. The evidence in MI formed the basis for the application of lytic agents, specifically Alteplase, to ischemic strokes. The theory, again, was that there was a clot sitting in a vessel, and administration of a lytic agent would dissolve the clot and improve patient outcomes by improving flow. Time is brain was pushed really hard as well, but it wasn't based on data pertaining to stroke, but based on the data pertaining to MI. So the NINS article, which we're going to discuss in a bit, was not the first trial looking at the utility of lytic agents in stroke. Prior to NINS, there were two major RCTs, the MAST Italy trial and the ECAS-1 trial. Both of these studies looked at a six-hour time window, so symptoms that started within 6 hours of drug administration, and found no benefit when streptokinase was given.
Yeah, I think that six-hour window for stroke came from that MI literature. And the thought was if thrombolytics worked with the heart within 6 hours, the hypothesis was that it would work for the brain in a similar fashion. Unfortunately, those two studies you mentioned with over 1,200 patients did not show benefit, and there was significant harm in the form of increased intracranial hemorrhage. So what's the official citation for this week's classic SGEM episode, the NINS paper?
So the article is Tissue Plasminogen Activator for Acute Ischemic Stroke, the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, RTPA Stroke Study Group. This was in the New England Journal in 1995. First thing to note here, Ken, is that this paper is two studies, not one. The two studies have different endpoints, and it wasn't clear to me, no matter how many times I read this, from the study, whether it was planned to split the study into two groups or two studies, or if the study was stopped in the middle, it was analyzed, the primary endpoint was then changed for the second half of the study.
Yeah, and don't worry, it wasn't clear to me either. I read through it a number of times, and I couldn't really nail that down. And this stuff always kind of bothers me, and it reminds me of that classic 1980s movie, Highlander, where the quote was,
"There can be only one."
And in this case, there can only be one primary endpoint. And as an EBM advocate, an evidence-based medicine advocate, things like this only raise my skeptical radar.
Absolutely. So the population here, it was all patients that had an ischemic stroke with a clearly defined time of onset, a deficit measurable by the NIHSS, and a baseline CT scan showing no intracranial hemorrhage.
What was the intervention?
So the intervention was administration of IV TPA at 0.9 milligrams per kilogram.
And how did they control the study?
So other patients received placebo.
And what was the outcome?
So again, there were two parts here, two studies. In part one, it was an improvement of more than 4 points from baseline NIHS stroke scale within 24 hours. In the second part, it was improvement in the Barthel Index or the modified Rankin stroke scale or the Glasgow Coma Outcome Scale, an NIHSS at 90 days.
And now there was a number of exclusions, and we don't need to go through all of them specifically because I'll throw them up in the blog, and they're important, but there are a number of exclusions to the NINS protocol.
Absolutely, and I think those exclusions are really critical if you're going to be giving this drug that you're running through all of those.
Yeah, and you need to know them, but there was more than five. And you know that if there's more than five anything, I can't count to them on one hand. And so I'll have to list them for everybody. So the author's conclusion from this study was, quote, despite an increased incidence of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, treatment with intravenous TPA within 3 hours of onset of ischemic stroke improved clinical outcome at 3 months, end of quote. Okay, Swami, so let's go through the 11 quality checklist that we do for critical appraisals of randomized clinical control trials. Can we go through those 11 questions with you?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, question number one, were these ED patients?
So this actually wasn't clear to me by reading the study, but I think they were ED patients.
Were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes, they were.
Was the randomization process concealed?
Yes, it was.
Were the patients analyzed in the group to which they were randomized?
Absolutely. So they analyzed them in the group that they were initially assigned to.
Were patients recruited consecutively?
So this one's a not exactly. So one of the caveats to this paper is that there had to be one patient included in the less than 90-minute group for every one patient in the greater than 90-minute group. Not explicitly stated, but we know that more patients present from 90 to 180 minutes. And so more patients or some patients in the 90 to 180 group had to be excluded for this one-to-one to happen.
Okay, and so question number six, were patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
So this one's also a no. If you look at table two in this study, you're going to see that the placebo group in both parts had a higher rate of large vessel occlusions. Subsequent reanalysis of the NINS data revealed a statistically significant imbalance in the initial stroke scale as well.
So why is this imbalance so important then?
Well, if you look at the outcome in the second study, the second part of NINS, it was an absolute, whether they ended up less than two or greater than two. So if you had patients who started with lower stroke scales, and so they were already less sick to begin with, then they were going to be less sick at the end as well. So this is pretty important if the groups weren't balanced.
And so the imbalance for the NINS part two, in the treatment arm, they were less sick?
That's correct. So this imbalance favors the group that got TPA.
So the bias, and bias means moves you away from the truth. So the bias in this part of the study would be for TPA to be effective. That would have a bias.
That's right.
All right. Well, question number seven. Were participants unaware of the groups they were allocated to?
Yes, they were.
Were groups treated equally except for the specific intervention?
Yes.
How about follow-up? Was it complete?
It was pretty good. It was almost complete. In part one, there was data missing for one patient out of 291. And in part two, there was data missing for just four patients out of 333.
And that's great. We're always looking for more than 80%, so they did really well with follow-up. Question number 10, were all patient important outcomes considered?
Yeah, I would say they were.
And the final question, question number 11 for the quality checklist in randomized control trials, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Well, in part one, there was no treatment effect. In part two, it's unclear whether this is true because the patients started at a different baseline.
So what were the results from this NINS trial?
So in part one, again, the primary endpoint was a better than 4-point improvement than NIHSS. They had a number of 290 patients in the study. In the TPA group, 47% had the primary endpoint. In the placebo group, 39% had the primary endpoint. And the p-value was 0.21, and it was not statistically significant.
So there was no significant difference, and I think we need to emphasize this. There was no significant difference at 24 hours with thrombolysis. No benefit.
That's right. So part one was a negative study.
Now, part two,
they've got a different primary endpoint. Here, it's an improvement in the stroke scale. So again, those four scales were the Barthel Index, the Modified Rankin Scale, the Glasgow Outcome Scale score, and the NIHSS. And now instead of 24 hours, it was at 90 days. Again, the number of patients here was 333, and regardless of which stroke scale you looked at, TPA patients did do better. So they had a reduction of 2 points in the modified Rankin scale at 90 days of 26% versus placebo, which was 39%, and that was an absolute benefit of 13%.
Yeah, and so what they were looking for, Swami, just to clarify that a bit, at 90 days, they considered a good outcome if you had a modified Rankin score of less than 2, so a 0 or 1 at 90 days. And there was shown to be benefit, an absolute difference of 13%, with 26% of people having a good outcome on a modified Rankin score of 0 to 1 at 90 days, compared to 39% with TPA.
Yeah, and that gave us an NNT of 8. And again, we noted this before, but now instead of continuous scale, this was sort of a hard cutoff. If you were below 2, that was a good outcome. If you were above 2, that was a bad outcome.
Yeah, and I'll put up the actual modified Rankin score on the blog so people can look at it. Because a 0, because the scale goes from 0 to 6, 0 was no symptoms at all, and a 1 is no significant disability despite symptoms, able to carry out all usual duties and activities. And then from 2 to 6 is worse, with, of course, 6 being death.
I think, one of the big criticisms on the modified Rankin scale is that a 2, which is slight disability, they can pretty much function on their own, is sort of lumped in with a 6, but we can get to that later.
So, Swami, there was some secondary outcomes as well.
Yeah, so the secondary endpoint in part two, or the second part of this NINS trial, was the primary endpoint in the first part. So it was an improvement in the NIHSS of greater than 4 points. And in the TPA group, they had that in 48% of patients. In the placebo group, it was only 39% of patients. But that difference was not statistically significant. So that's really the same result as in the first part.
Very interesting, isn't it, that they made the primary outcome from part one, the 24-hour benchmark that they were looking at, and then flip that around to a secondary outcome at 90 days for part two. And in that one, there was no difference as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it sort of raises our eyebrows from the skeptic standpoint of whether this was planned in advance or whether this was a stop in the study and then sort of data mining to find something that was beneficial and then flipping them around.
Yeah, I'm not sure. How about harm, though? We always have to consider harm. We've talked about benefit. We've talked about primary and secondary outcome. when it comes to benefit. But what about harm in this study?
Yes, so symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage was really the big harm that we were looking at here. So in the TPA group, they had 20 symptomatic ICHs, and 9 of those, or 45%, were fatal in ICH in the TPA group. And this gives us the infamous 6.4% symptomatic ICH bleed rate. In the placebo group, there were only 2 patients with a symptomatic ICH, and 1 of those was also fatal. So the 50% mortality rate there, and a symptomatic ICH rate of just 0.6%. So a big difference, 6.4% symptomatic ICH rate in the TPA group, 0.6% in the placebo group. Now, there were also some asymptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, but that was about equal in the groups. TPA, about 14 patients, placebo group, 9 patients. Overall, the 6.4% symptomatic bleed rate versus 0.6% gives us a number needed to harm of about 16 patients.
And despite this NNH of 16, which you just described, of harm, there was no difference in mortality at the end, correct?
That's absolutely right. So Ken, if you look at these results, you would quickly come to the conclusion that alteplase was beneficial in the treatment of ischemic CVA and that the benefits outweigh the harms. But there's a lot of caveats to this.
Well, let's talk about some of those caveats then.
Absolutely. So the NNIH stroke scale was higher in the placebo group, but there was no significant change. So the placebo group had to be sicker at baseline. And this is actually shown in some reanalysis of the NINS data in 2004, and subsequently was shown by a number of other researchers. So again, you ask the question, why does this matter? Well, remember, in part one, there was a continuous measure of outcomes. They were looking for a 4-point improvement on the NIH stroke scale. This isn't really affected as much by the patients being different at baseline. A 4-point improvement is a 4-point improvement. However, in part two, it was a dichotomous outcome, and this is where they showed a benefit to TPA. If the patients who were given TPA were less sick at baseline, they're more likely to be less sick at the end of the study, regardless of the treatment. And the reverse is true for the placebo group. So since the placebo group was sicker at baseline, it's less likely that they got to a good outcome in this dichotomized endpoint. Additionally, there was a difference in outcomes if you were treated at less than 90 minutes versus in the 90 to 180 minute group. The majority of benefit really was seen in the less than 90 group, but they lumped them in with the 90 to 180 group and tried to argue that 0 to 180 is all the same. But it doesn't appear that that's true based on this paper. And why does this matter? Well, we know that very few patients come in at less than 90 minutes after symptoms. So if you only recommend the drug to this group, you won't use it very often.
So we always like to consider the information and then put it towards our clinical practice. Does this information from NINS 1995 change what we do?
Well, Ken, I think you know the answer to this. Of course it did. This study is the heart of all of the stroke care that we've had over the last 20 years. Stroke alerts, stroke codes, stroke centers, multiple studies, and billions of dollars have been invested or come from this paper. And this seems like a lot to me for what amounts to a single study of 333 patients with baseline differences which showed a benefit.
Yeah, and if you look at it, I mean, it was only half the patients who actually received treatment. So this means we've made all these changes, all these systematic changes, based on 170, roughly, patients that received TPA. And you know, there are many examples in the literature of one randomized control trial with great results, only later shown to be not true or much less effective. And I can think of one example from last week. I mean, we did the episode called Cry Me a River. And in 2001, Dr. Rivers published his great early goal-directed therapy paper showing his bundled care for sepsis resulted in significantly less mortality. And yet the PROCESS trial compared early goal-directed therapy to protocol care, to, quote, usual care, and showed no difference. And as a skeptic, I would always caution people to wait for validation studies before accepting one randomized control trial as the truth.
Yeah, I think that this is a great example of that. You know, if you look a little bit differently, the MI studies, the MI data, that caused us also to make some pretty significant changes. We have MI centers, we have a cath team, a cath alert, a STEMI code, and that was based on 60,000 patients, not 333 patients. And we sort of looked and looked and looked and found the same benefit over and over again and said, this is a change we should make. But the adoption of TPA by the American Heart Association may have been strongly influenced by some monetary issues. So it's sort of been well publicized that Genentech, the maker of TPA in the United States, and it's called Boehringer Ingelheim outside of the U.S., gave $11 million to the American Heart Association just prior to the AHA endorsing this drug.
Oh, and this fits so well here. When you say $11 million, I mean, it conjures up Dr. Evil, doesn't it?
$1 million.
Now, Swami, this is just an association, and we're not saying that there's necessarily a cause and effect. I'm not aware of any direct evidence, I don't know if you are, linking money from Genentech to change AHA recommendations. But I admit, it doesn't look very good, and we should be careful in any conclusions we make about this part of the TPA story.
Absolutely. And regardless, Ken, 20 years later, this continues to be a hot-button topic in emergency medicine. You can see more on this debate if you go to the MCRIT site, where I had a debate with Andy Jagoda, who's one of the shapers of the ACEP clinical policy that just came out last year. And that ACEP updated clinical policy gives a pretty strong endorsement for TPA within 3 hours. And this drove the EM community nuts. The policy is currently open, or may have just closed, for comment and feedback. And this is going to be readdressed within this year as to what these recommendations are going to be.
Yeah, and the ACEP recommendations was, quote, TPA should be offered to all patients who qualify in the less than 3 hour time window. But it was a grade A recommendation, a grade A recommendation. And grade A recommendations are generally accepted principles for patient management that reflects a high degree of clinical certainty, i.e., based on strengths of class one or overwhelming evidence from strength of evidence from class two studies that directly address all of the issues. And a recent EP monthly poll showed that emergency medicine community certainly does not consider TPA for stroke a grade A recommendation. There were 88% of physicians who thought that new ACEP guidelines should either be revised or rescinded. And the guidelines, they left some wiggle room in there. I mean, they did say should be offered. However, there are only two RCTs that have shown benefit. One at the three-hour window, this was NINS that we're talking about, part two, and one for the three-hour to four-and-a-half-hour window, and that was ECAS-3. Those are the multiple studies, both of them. But there have been four studies that were stopped early due to harm or unlikely to prove beneficial, and then six more studies that showed no overall benefit. And I'll throw up a nice little table that summarizes all of those things.
Yeah, and on a personal level, Ken, I want to say NINS was important to me because it led to my interest in EBM. So my first year out as an attending, we had a patient very similar to the one that we discussed here who came in and got TPA, and I thought it was inappropriate to give that patient TPA. I thought that they had some relative contraindications that should take them out. And the patient ended up having a massive and fatal intracranial hemorrhage. And this case really prompted me to go back, read up on NINS, which of course then pushes you to read the rest of this literature, the subsequent studies, and critically review them. You could say that TPA got me hooked on EBM, actually.
Well, I think it's great that the study did get you hooked on EBM because you've been a very outspoken, skeptical, critical reviewer of the literature. And I think everyone should look at it for themselves and think, how do I apply this to my practice? Well, the bottom line from my standpoint was, you know, I'm skeptical. That's not a stretch for me, but I'm skeptical that thrombolysis has benefit for acute stroke. I'm not saying it doesn't work. I'm just saying it hasn't been proven to me that it does work.
Yeah, so, and in the discussion that we had, the debate that I had with Andy Jagoda, that's on MCRIT, you know, I said the same thing. I think this drug is probably right for somebody, for some patient group, but we just haven't figured out which group that is yet.
So can you tie this up and resolve the case for me?
Yeah, absolutely. So based on your in-depth knowledge of the NINS study, you point out to the neurologist that the patient may be a poor candidate for TPA based on her presenting blood pressure, her age, and the fact that her symptoms had been improving while she was in the ED. The neurologist and you have a discussion with the patient and her family about the risks and benefits. Given her improving symptoms, they elect to decline TPA treatment. The patient's admitted to the stroke unit, And a week later, she's got a little bit better strength, 4+ out of 5, in her upper extremity and lower extremity. She's speaking clearly still, and she's discharged to the rehab center for further care.
Well, Swami, that concludes the second ever SGEM Classic Critical Paper Review. If you, in the listening audience, have any suggestions of other groundbreaking, practice-changing, historic emergency medicine literature that you think we should review, then drop me an email to thesgem@gmail.com with classic in the subject heading, and we're happy to take a look. And I'd have to have you, the classic SGEM reviewer, back to do the paper.
I'd love to do another one. So please send in some classic papers for us to look at.
So the Keener contest winner from last week was again from Poland. These Polish docs are kissing everybody's beep. That's 2 weeks in a row for Poland. And this week it was Jarek from Krakow, and he identified 3 important things in sepsis care, and they were early recognition of sepsis and get a lactate level, lots of intravenous fluids, and broad-spectrum antibiotics. So congratulations, Poland. You are setting an example. Swami, will you be kind enough to give the Keener contest for this week on thrombolysis?
Absolutely. So can you name the doctor who published a study in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in 1958, suggesting thrombolysis may work for stroke? If you think you know the answer, send Ken an email at thesgem@gmail.com and use Keener in the subject line. The first person with the correct answer is going to receive a cool skeptical prize from Ken.
Well, thanks again, Swami. Always a pleasure to have you on the SGEM. Will you do me the honor of saying the tagline?
Absolutely. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.